Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Atayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen in izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cook guests. And we have had sushi chefs in the last two episodes, a private chef from Japan and sustainability-minded American sushi chefs in New York. And my guest today is another talented sushi chef, David Yoshitomo Arabak, who is the chef owner of Yoshitomo in Omaha, Nebraska. And Japanese sushi has become a part of the American food culture. Now you can see great non-Japanese sushi chefs in the U.S. who prove that sushi does not belong only to Japan. These chefs inspire the tradition and make it evolve further. And David is a classic example. He is nominated for Best Chef Midwest by the James Beard Foundation in 2023. And this year, his restaurant Yoshitomo has been nominated for the 2024 Outstanding Restaurant Award by the foundation as a semi-finalist. And the result will be announced on June 10th in Chicago. Also, the Washington Post named Yoshitomo one of America's best sushi restaurants in December 2023. So today we'll discuss how David got into the world of sushi, how he studied sushi making in Omaha, Nebraska, where beef is the king, his original sushi that merges the tradition and American-style umami, and his collaboration with Japanese chefs, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We truly appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start our conversation with David Yoshitomo Arabak. Hello, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be on a show that I actually listen to.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Right. And congratulations on the James Beard nomination for the Outstanding Restaurant Award, which is a huge deal.
Yeah, so, thank you. Thank you. It's been kind of a crazy couple of months.
Yeah, or years, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So we'll discuss all about your efforts and success and everything else. So to get to know you first, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
So my family was military, so I've kind of lived all over the world, but I've spent most of my life here in Omaha, Nebraska, and so, you know, about 30 years. So, you know, I guess now I have to claim, you know, that I'm from Omaha, Nebraska. Growing up, you know, we were, you know, my dad is from Iowa, and, you know, we didn't have access to a lot of Japanese food, and so the food that I ate growing up was a lot of just regular, you know, kind of Midwestern family food, you know, steak and corn, mashed potatoes. My mom would make some Japanese food, but, you know, most of my eating has just been kind of standard Midwest food.
Mm, right. So your mother is Japanese and her last name is Yoshitomo. Is that?
No, my mother is from Okinawa, Kumejima. Yeah, her last name was Ota.
Okay. Huh, interesting.
So I have to find out why you named your restaurant Yoshitomo later. But, oh, that's very cool. So Kumejima, that's amazing. Wow. So you have a very culturally intense blood in your DNA.
Yes.
Awesome. Great. And but, you know, growing up in the Midwest, how did you get into cooking and also in particular sushi?
So, you know, it wasn't ever really my plan. You know, I was just a young man. I was working a couple of jobs. I was in a band. I was going to school. I was living in a house with like 11 people, you know, just so poor. And someone living in my house, they said that the restaurant, the sushi restaurant they were working at, was hiring a sushi chef. And sushi is my favorite food. And, you know, I never get to eat it because I was so poor. So I figured working in a restaurant as a sushi chef, I could get to eat free food and get to eat sushi. So I applied. You know, being Japanese, I immediately got hired, right? Because there's no Japanese sushi chef. So it was like one of the few times, like, you know, it's being Japanese, like, got me the job. Yeah. And so, you know, even then, my plan wasn't really to work in restaurants. You know, I was going to go to school and do something with my life. Very few people who work in restaurants like choose that job. It kind of, you know, the restaurant life chooses you. It's kind of like pirates, right? Mm. So at a certain point, I had just been making sushi, you know, for a while, and it just kind of stuck.
Mm, right. So that sounds like what's called destiny, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. So, and tell us about your sushi training. So who was your sushi sensei, and what style of sushi did you study?
So I have no sensei. You know, in the beginning, there were people who could make the sushi menu, and they taught me the basics. But, you know, around here, especially at the time, you know, the basics, you know, it's really just, this is how you make nigiri. This is how you make California roll. And then now you work at the restaurant, you know? So I don't really have a sensei who really had any real training, and no one around me had any training either, mm-hmm. You know? So when I finally decided to, you know, pursue this as a professional, it was, you know, it was after my first trip to Japan. Mm. And you know, this was 2009, 2010. I Googled best sushi in Japan, and the restaurant that came up was, I showed it to my concierge at my hotel, and they made me a reservation for the next day. And the restaurant was Sukiyabashi Jiro.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I didn't know really anything about it. I just wanted to go eat the best sushi. And that meal really changed my life. I didn't know that there were professionals and this level of food. And so, you know, when I left that meal, I really, really wanted to be a sushi chef, like a real one. But I came home, and there's no one to train you. Even at the time, you know, 2009, there's maybe less than 10 omakase counter in the United States.
Mm.
So from then on, I have to train myself. So I'm like Ronin, I guess. I don't know, like just no master.
Right.
Yeah. So because of that, you know, I study everybody. I eat a lot of sushi. I eat with anybody I can. And I try to learn from everybody that I eat with.
Mm. Well, that's interesting, right? Because, you know, listeners may be familiar with the movie Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which happened to be the restaurant you went to.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure I was before the movie came out, right? Because you were able to get a table.
Yes, I was actually the only guest at the restaurant that day.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. So again, that's a destiny. You were supposed to be, that was the most authentic restaurant.
I had been making sushi for maybe 3 years at the time. And so, you know, they asked me what my job was. And I told them in, you know, my terrible Japanese, I was a sushi chef. And, you know, the father and the son, you know, Jiro and you know, Yoshikazu just looked at each other for a second, and then they laughed at me for like a really long time, you know, like an embarrassingly long time. They laughed at me.
Well, that's the thing, right? So for Japanese chefs, the sushi has to be trained. Maybe for like the way the dreams, Jiro Dormu Sushi describes, it takes years and years, and something that you really learn from one teacher. But the way you have learned sushi and you're going to keep learning and became one of the best sushi chefs in America, according to James Beard and other, all those media or, you know, respectable resources, I think it really indicates something of the future of sushi, right? Because you have to keep evolving. And Jiro may not laugh at you anymore because you have to be open-minded. There's so many different kinds of inspirations all over the world. And from the Edo period up to now, tradition evolved and it's very solidified. So there's nothing to lose for the Japanese tradition. But the market is global. We discover, like your sushi, I was looking at your whole menu on Instagram. I just want to eat it too. So it's the different idea of what's delicious and what people enjoy. And that all those new mindset, I think Japanese sushi chefs are inspired by you. So
yeah, you know, I think sushi is always, you know, it's steeped in tradition for sure, right? But it has always been about, you know, small evolutions. Even edamame sushi, yes, there's, you know, the techniques and the way you're supposed to do it and the particular items that you use. But most of the fish that's used in edamame sushi, you cannot get, you know, anymore out of Tokyo. So even there's been forced evolution, you know, in even the craft, you know, and so as it's gone around the world, you know, it's starting to do what it needs to do and adapt to its location.
Right. So that's the whole essence of edamame sushi. Edamame means Tokyo Bay called sushi. the ingredients will happen to be overcoming from Tokyo Bay. But now, I think in the interpretation, they happen to be born by the Tokyo Bay. But it could have been Seto Uchi Sea or Japan Seaside. So it's just the nature. You have this fish available. You make it into portable, easy to enjoy, and not too expensive. That was the essence back then in Edo period when the sushi was born. It's like a fast food sold out of the cart. So that's the essence of sushi. It has to be locally, reasonably available, and that's the essence. It can be, I don't know, Atlantic Ocean or Mediterranean Sea. It's just all the new sushi is not new. It's the local, sustainable, and reasonable. So that's what you're doing, I think, in Omaha.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to do. It's you know, it's difficult to adapt some, you know, everything local. You know, our local terroir. You know, river fish don't really work well for sushi. You know, so it's trying to find ways to, you know, use our local tastes to kind of give us a path on how we should make our food here.
Right. For example, you use amazing beef on your sushi, which totally makes sense. And Wagyu sushi also, it's available in Japan too. So why not? Right? You don't have to stick with one type of ingredients. That's why avocado sushi is so delicious as well.
Yeah. You know, a cow is just a tuna that lives on the land, you know?
Right. Yeah, rich in iron and all those minerals. That is very true. Very nutritious too. So, and you proved your talent at the Blue Restaurant Group in Omaha, which has multiple locations in now 12 states. And you worked there for over 12 years. And what did you learn from the experience at the Blue Restaurant Group?
So, you know, working for the Blue Restaurant Group was maybe, you know, you said destiny, and it's probably perfect, right? You know, I started with the company when they just had one location, and I became the chef of their second location, but then became maybe not official title, but the de facto corporate sushi chef over the next 10 years. And so I helped build the company, develop the menus, design kitchens, manage staff in multiple states, implement, cleaning programs, corporate programs, talk to health departments. But also most importantly, I'm in the room with the ownership, every month as they're talking about financials and how to grow the company, what's successful, and seeing kind of how a company grows from one small location to now, gosh, they have 15, 16, 19, so many locations. Company is huge. They made their money on sushi, but the menu didn't change very often. Just small changes here and there. And it was my job to sort of find new ingredients, source better product, make the sushi experience at Blue better. But I think the thing that I learned most and maybe most importantly was how to run a business, right? You can, owning a restaurant is 90% running the business, 10% making the food. Without that, the whole thing kind of falls apart. And so, learning how to make the whole business work was maybe the number one thing that I took from the company.
Mm, right. Well, that's really crucial to be successful as a business owner. We're going to discuss, you have three restaurants, which is very impressive. You got lucky to have your friend living together in an 11 people household and got introduced to that restaurant. So
yeah,
that's amazing. All right, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into David's original style of sushi at the Yoshitomo. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama. My guest today is David Yoshitomo Arbuck, who is the chef owner of Yoshitomo, Ota and Koji in Omaha, Nebraska. His outstanding sushi has been widely recognized by the James Beard Foundation and the powerful media outlets and so forth. So you could have stayed at the Blue Restaurant Group comfortably as a corporate chef, but you decided to open your own restaurant, Yoshitomo, in 2017. So what is the concept of Yoshitomo and why did you name it Yoshitomo?
So Yoshitomo is my middle name. So, looking for something that gives a Japanese restaurant authenticity, Yoshitomo. Well, you know, that's pretty authentic. And at the time, you know, Morimoto's, you know, very popular. Like, it's just Nobu, all the best restaurants have the name of the chef, right?
And Yoshitomo sounds like a name of shogun. So
yeah,
that's really cool. Super cool.
You know, if it was called, you know, David Sushi or Utterback Sushi, you know, I don't think it would be as taken seriously, you know. So Yoshitomo gives me a little bit of credibility there. But when I decided to open up the restaurant, I had been working for the Blue Company for a long time. And, you know, the company makes, they're just a big corporate restaurant, right? They make a lot of sushi for a lot of people, very successful. But, you know, I had gone to Japan. I wanted to be a really great omakase chef. And that's just not the place where I could pursue that. You know, the company does things a certain way, and I wanted to be more of a craftsman. I wanted to be like my heroes. And so at a certain point, you have to decide whether you're going to help other people chase their dreams or you're going to chase your dream. You know, either is fine. You just kind of have to commit. You can't do both. So it was time for me to split. Yoshitomo original concept was really about, I needed a job. I didn't want to work for anyone else. I had some ideas of what I wanted to do, but the Yoshitomo that I opened with and the Yoshitomo of today are completely different restaurants. I thought that I would just open, you know, kind of the Midwestern sushi bar that I came from, just maybe with some little bit better food. And I wouldn't have to be anyone's boss, you know? So when we opened, we had sake bombs and California rolls and soy sauce on the table. We gave out ginger and wasabi. We did all the stuff that sushi restaurants do around here. But pretty quickly, we learned that the guests were starting to order more of the items that were more high end, you know, plated dishes, sashimi dishes. They were ordering more nigiri than I had ever made at any of my other jobs. And so it became pretty easy to see that the clientele and the guests wanted more. They wanted something nicer than they had been eating at. And so the concept changed pretty quickly to go, okay, what are all the things that I wish that I could do at a restaurant, but I was always too afraid to do? Let's just do it. And every time we did it, it was really scary. It's like, okay, we're going to take the California roll off the menu. That's like the engine. That's the cheeseburger. It makes the whole thing work, right? We're going to take soy sauce off the table. We're going to not give the guests any wasabi. We're not going to have, you know, cheap sake. We're not going to have all the stuff that I really wished that I could do. I just decided to do it pretty much, you know, within the first year. And that's, we've just kind of taken that further and further as time has gone on. So the concept of Yoshitomo now would be, it's kind of a sushi restaurant. I wouldn't even really call it a Japanese restaurant. You know, it's just become a restaurant where I cook the things and make food that I really, really enjoy myself. And it happens that a lot of that food is, you know, Japanese based. But I try not to put too hard of a label on things. I'm not a very good creative chef. So it's really hard for me to just, you know, if I have too many options, I get a little bit overwhelmed. So the concept of Yoshitomo is now, you know, we're a restaurant that specializes in sushi, and it's a little more fine dining, not quite fine dining, but maybe kind of casual fine dining, right?
Mm. Right. Well, that's, isn't it that trend? Even New York or any big cities, people want to have comfortable feeling and eating the finest food available. So, yeah, I think that is the trend of all those, regardless of the price. So I'm really looking at this amazing Instagram photos and your menu. It's definitely, it looks very authentic. Some like sushis look like very authentic, but there's some twists in it. So that's very exciting. So let's talk about some of the examples that you really want to introduce to the listeners who have never been to your place?
Yeah. So, you know, for us, you know, we have your regular sort of traditional sushi, right? We have, you know, all, you know, tuna, salmon, all of those items, you know, but there's got to be room for new invention. There's got to be room for evolution. So it's important for us to have all of the things that define a sushi restaurant. But I think it's also important to see if there's more to it, right? And so we've got a whole menu of what we call bites, but essentially those bites are just a reinterpretation of nigiri, you know, maybe more of a composed nigiri, more ingredients. I guess if you know, it would be closer to a Kyushu or a Southern style, actually, nigiri, you know. So of course, you know, we're really kind of famous for our aburi wagyu, which is it's a beef sushi, but we cure it for 3 days in koji, and then it gets torched and served with a little bit of uni butter and just some nigiri. And it's, you know, essentially it's just, you know, it's the best steak bite in town. It just happens to be sort of in a sushi form. Very popular. That one is, we sell more, almost as much beef as we do tuna every week.
Right. Well, I wish, I've never been to your place, just to be clear, but I am looking at this whole amazing pictures. And then, for example, this Instagram picture that looks very authentic, but this is about shrimp kobujime and with the fat XO shrimp oil. And it's just, you can tell this is umami essence or concentrated flavor of fish umami. And who doesn't think of that, right? I wish it existed yesterday and I never tried it. So that kind of thing, but it looks very authentic. And your sushi rice is very unique, right? The Agazu sushi rice or...
So, you know, each restaurant, the recipe for the rice is a little bit different. And that, you know, for Yoshitomo, you know, we used kind of a standard sushi rice. You know, in the Ota counter, we're using Akazu. Yoshitomo restaurant uses a little bit of Akazu in our vinegar. You know, but I've also learned, you know, from my previous experience, you know, the sweeter sushi rice is, the more guests seem to really like the sushi. And so, you know, the rice, you know, Yoshitomo is sweeter than the rice that's served at the omakase counter Ota. And so they're all a little bit different.
Interesting. And you also have the regular white looking sushi rice at the Yoshitomo too, right? So yeah, I really think that you consider the combination very seriously. And yeah, and it's stunning. It's how it looks is really more exciting than the whole traditional sushi, which is simple and beautiful. But there's something exciting, and I feel like asking you questions. How did you come up with this? So that's the presentation is really important, and you're very successful about that too, to trigger interest in sushi.
Yeah, you know, so you know, the bites are kind of, you know, can we use other items? Can we use other items to make sushi? You know, and what is the definition of sushi? You know, when people ask, you know, I like to tell them, as long as there's sushi rice involved, everything is sushi, right? You can, I'm sure there's just so many people who just heard that, you know, listening to the show and just going, no way, absolutely not. But if you go all through Japan, the construction of sushi just changes, right? Sometimes it's in a bowl, sometimes it's in a hako, you know, sometimes it's a bozushi. The construction can change, as long as the sushi rice is the most important. So always looking for how can we make new sushis, right? So we have like a gunkan that we put foie gras, and we top it with a little bit of nitsume and like a cherry boshi, right? It's almost like a dessert, but you know, it's sushi. It doesn't look like any sushi, you know, that most people make, but that sushi rice is there. It's in a gunkan, you know, a sushi chef made it. It's, you know, to me, that's sushi. But we have other items like, you know, one of our really famous items that we're known for is called Hama Toast. And we just take a negi hamachi and we put it on top of a sourdough toast that we make here in house. And the toast is soaked in like a tamari brown butter. And, you know, there's no sushi rice in that one, right? So not sushi. But to me, that item is kind of like sushi. You know, you replace the rice, you need something that's starch, that's sour, sourdough. You know, you replace that sushi rice with another item that kind of has, you know, some characteristics of sushi, you know, and so that bite, you know, it's, we use that toast a lot to introduce items to guests that maybe they wouldn't normally, you know, order, like uni or something like that. It's a great introduction to, you know, if I have a guest that says, I don't like uni, I go, hold on. And I put it on the toast with the brown butter. And then all of a sudden now they're a fan of uni, right? So we can use some of these items as sort of a gateway to get guests out of their comfort zone and trying some new things.
Mm. Right, but the combination totally makes sense. Like, you know, when I grew up in Japan, there's a bata gohan means like the hot rice, white rice, and with butter and soy mixed in. That's like your tamari brown butter combination.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So, right, this kind of classic umami combination. And the sourdough, I think, has a magical live taste of umami. So, yeah, this is exciting because what you're serving, the layering flavors of different unexpected ingredients, that makes sense, which I think is why you've been successful. So it's not just a like whimsical combination. You really, I can tell, you really thought the combinations very deeply with reference to tradition and also your own sense of umami. Mm. Right. Okay, so let's talk about your other two restaurants, Ota and Koji, because you mentioned Ota already. So what are the concepts of Ota and Koji?
So Ota would be, you know, I've been doing omakase for about 10, 11 years now. In the beginning, I was just stealing counter space from my friends' restaurants when they were closed, and I would host these omakase dinners. And, you know, at the time there was, you know, Chicago didn't have anything. The only counters was New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles. And so for, I would say 5 years, I was the only person practicing, you know, omakase sushi, you know, in between, you know, for the whole middle of America, there was no one else doing it. And so, you know, in the early days, it was me borrowing and traveling every week, every month to go do that. And eventually, when we opened up Yoshitomo, we had space for our own counter. And so the Ota counters is kind of, you know, that's my counter. That's where I work. That's, you know, it's a, you know, traditional format omakase meal. It's all the high end ingredients. You know, I'm sourcing everything from Kyushu, Fukuoka, Toyosu. You know, I'm using the same ingredients and purveyors and contacts that, you know, the Michelin counters are using, and then having stuff that is sent from friends who are working in Japan, you know, in Tokyo. And so it's really my attempt to do the sushi that I've always wanted to do. And then we have Koji. Koji is kind of it looks more like the restaurant that I came from, the Blue Restaurant. Very sort of accessible Midwest sushi. But that restaurant, we specialize in yakitori. So, you know, we've spent the last couple of years trying to teach ourselves yakitori and do it the right way, you know, grilled over real binchotan, getting whole chickens from the farm, breaking them all down, you know, and really trying to pursue true yakitori, which is also very rare outside of New York, LA, and San Francisco. But Koji is a closer cousin to that Midwestern sushi bar that most guests around here are used to. A little more accessible, you know, less high refinement and it's, you know, closer to a kind of an izakaya, I would say.
Right. So koji can be the entrance to Yoshitomo and
yeah.
Ota.
We have levels, right? Koji, Yoshitomo, and then Ota.
Well, I'm sure you're having fun and discovering how to cook yakitori. That's a whole nother deep world too.
Oh, it's so hard.
Wow, that's amazing. So, okay. And, well, so you mentioned you collaborate, you have friends, sushi chefs from Japan and based in Japan, and you do collaboration dinners or events. So how, I mean, sushi world traditionally, they're not so connected as, you know, other chefs do not do collaboration in Japan traditionally, but you seem to be very active. You're working with other sushi chefs. So what kind of dinners or events do you do? And also, how do you find all those guest chefs?
So, you know, for me, because I don't have a teacher, I don't have anyone who can show me things, you know, I have to be a student, right? I have to go to different dinners. I have to see what people are doing. And I travel everywhere. I try to go to every city that has a counter worth visiting, and I try to go. Because there's always something to learn from everybody. And so in my travels, I will find other sushi chefs who I feel connected to. I'm in a sushi otaku. I just love the culture. I'm a big super fan of everybody. And when I meet somebody who is also very skilled, but doesn't quite have the same maybe training that I do, I feel very connected to them, and I want to see how they got there and how they do it. And so, I will go to a dinner, and I will just at the dinner ask them, "Hey, I'm a sushi chef. I want to do a dinner with you. Will you come to my restaurant, or can I come to your restaurant?" And that's just kind of how I find them. They're counters where I'm in the middle of dinner and I love this dinner and I really want to like make sushi with you. And sushi chefs normally don't work together, right? But I really think that collaboration and the friendships are really important and they're important for me. And so when we do dinners, oftentimes they're all different. Oftentimes I will have them come to my restaurant and make their sushi and I will make their sushi. So I'll use their rice, their techniques, and I try to learn, right? Because everybody's kind of got a different style. So, you know, when I had Otto Fan from Kyoten in Omaha, I said, you know, Otto, I want you to make your sushi. I'm also going to work the counter with you and I'm going to make your sushi too. So we can give my guests experience with another sushi chef, but also I have experience learning someone else's philosophy. And you learn some little tricks here and there. And then through those dinners, we share information with each other. And same with, you know, I've worked with big good friends. Actually, later this month, I'll be with Nick Bognar at Sado in St. Louis. He's like another, you know, just great sushi chef. Chris Massad, you know, from Kampai. I think I've worked most with Hiroyuki Sato from Hakoku in Ginza. You know, I'll bring him over. I'll make his sushi like I'm an apprentice. You know, I'll go over to his restaurant. You know, he becomes my apprentice for a day, which is really fun to have a world famous sushi chef as your, you know, apprentice for the day.
That's amazing.
It's part of, it's one of the ways how I train, how I learn.
But I think as much as you learn from those chefs, probably the invitation to your restaurant that could be one of the highest accolades they can get, right? Because who appreciate that much? I want to make sushi with you because you're amazing. And I think that's really inspiring and also, you know, motivating for them to keep going. And of course, like, you know, Hiroyuki Sato of Hakkoku in Ginza, he's really highly recognized chef. And I'm sure he learns a lot from you too. So you are, without knowing, you're inspiring traditional Japanese restaurants all over the place in the world. That is very exciting. So how do you fine tune your style of sushi though? Because you want to keep evolving, but you have so much to learn from. So do you have anything specific philosophy you want to do, you don't want to do, or something like that?
Yeah, you know, so for me, because I don't, you know, of course, again, I don't have a teacher. So, you know, one of the great things about being an apprentice is, you know, you come to a restaurant, they've got 4, 5, 6 generations of people who have made all the mistakes and learned the best way to do something. And when you learn as an apprentice, you learn day one, they show you, here's how you do the saba. This is how you do it. Why? Because we perfected it. And so now you're going to do it this way. And when you get finished with your training, you can make beautiful sushi. But I don't know if you have a lot of diverse experiences in that sushi, right? And so for me, I having to teach myself, I have to pick up little tricks. I get recipes or technique from all over. And most of them come from me eating at other counters. So if I'm eating at, you know, Tenzushi in Kyushu, I'm eating, you know, a totally different style and I'm picking things up. Oh, I really like this flavor combination. I love how we made this. I like this philosophy. If I'm in Chicago at, you know, Kyoten, oh, I really like how sharp his shari is, or I really like the way he presented these items. And so now my style of sushi is really confused, right? It's preservation, you know, aging jukusei from edamame sushi. It's combining ingredients to make a new one from, you know, Kyushu style. You know, there's American sensibility in there. It's really confused. It's almost like if a barbecue chef learned to make barbecue in 6 different cities and then tried to make, you know, his own style, everybody would say it's wrong because everybody has an idea of what a specific regional style is, right? But here I'm very lucky because the experience level for, you know, high-end sushi is limited. And so I have the freedom to do whatever I want. And so, you know, I don't really have a style, I guess, you know, my style is my style, but I don't have any rules or I don't put any limitations. You know, for me, when I create sushi, I first want it to be bold. I think food should taste bold. And most sushi is not bold. And a lot of Japanese food isn't bold. Even when someone says, oh, this sushi chef's sushi is really bold, I'll eat it and go, no, that's maybe a little bit more bold than normal, but very rarely is sushi just so flavorful. It's usually very reserved in its flavors. And to me, you know, as an American, especially in the Midwest, all the things that people crave and all the things that we love, they're strong. Their flavors are really strong, right? When I crave something, I want pizza and hot dogs and chili cheese dog and, you know, cheeseburger. I'm never going, oh man, I just can't wait until I get that, you know, lightly flavored consomme broth again, you know, or I could just eat that, you know, piece of lettuce with a spritz of lemon juice on it. You know, I crave really strong flavored foods and I think everyone else does too. And so a majority of my sushi ends up being very, very strong, super bold, super strong. But then beyond that, I don't try to think about what my guests would like or what somebody else would like. Because they're not there for me to fine tune that item. If I go, okay, what would Akiko like? All right, I'm going to try to make a dish for her. Well, you're not here to eat that dish 15 times until I get it right. And so I can't make it perfect. And so I only cook from my palate, and my experience at this point, eating at all these counters and eating so much sushi, I feel like I have a pretty good palate. And so I know that if I really, really like it, then it's really, really good. And if you come to my restaurant and you like my food, then you like my palate. But if I cook any other food than something that I like to eat, then you may come to the restaurant and not like it. So guests that don't like our restaurant and don't like our food, that's cool, because they can go to another restaurant where they're going to get the food that they like. But here, I know that if my eyes roll in the back of my head after I make a piece of a sushi, I know everybody who comes to my restaurant is going to like it because they like my palate. And so that's really, really what I try to do is just, I cook for me. And when everybody in the restaurant agrees that it has to go on the menu, then it's ready and it's good. And that's it. That's how we try to do it.
Right. Well, you made a couple of interesting points, because I think, thinking of, do I go to the restaurant that the chef makes something for me, imagining I would like this, it never works. And I always admire a restaurant where I get the food that I didn't know I would like so much. So it's the surprise of new discoveries that I liked it. And also, So I really think that you are almost obsessed with creating something you like, and you feel like sharing that with your guests. And
it's like when you go to go see a painting or a painter, you don't go to the museum and go, I want to see Michelangelo paint, like someone else. I want to see his work, right? Like, I don't want to see Michelangelo do comic book art, or I don't want to see Michelangelo paint, something else. I want to see his original works.
And I think also, I remember now that when I read Zeppi of Noma, I read his quote. He said, "The worst thing in life is to do the same thing as yesterday." And I like that idea. His cooking has been evolving very quickly, very deeply. And I think, you cook because you believe in something delicious to be served, to be discovered. And I think you have that mindset, the same mindset as Rene.
Yeah. I get bored very quickly. Maybe it's my ADD or something, but, I always have to, moving on to the next thing.
Right. So you mentioned earlier that your customer's palate, when you opened Yoshitomo, you didn't expect that people look for something more refined, elaborate dishes, but obviously people's palates are changing, developing very quickly, maybe thanks to the internet and all those traveling becomes possible. So how do you see your guests' demographics and preferences changed over time since you started cooking, making sushi in Omaha area? Because I think we tend to think about LA or New York or those big cities. That's what American people are eating sushi. But I think it's important that there are different preferences. Like you said, big taste. That's the Midwest people prefer. So how do you see the change, and how to describe what people are looking for in sushi?
Yeah. So, over time, I started making sushi in 2004, 2005, something like that. And back then, essentially all sushi restaurants were pretty much the same. Every city, every restaurant, they were making kind of the same sushi, nigiri, simple rolls. They all had the, bento box with the, with the chicken and the California roll. All the restaurants were the same. And when I started I was making a lot of that sushi. And over time, you know, the sushi itself has gotten a lot more creative for sure. Especially in the Midwest, you know, it's all about what kind of crazy sushi rolls can you come up with? You know, how weird can you make it? And those tastes are getting stronger, but also the people eating sushi now, you know, before, now we have generations of people who grew up on it. And, you know, my generation, you know, I grew up eating sushi just a couple of times a year. It was an expensive meal for my family. There was only one restaurant in town where you could do it. And I think that's a lot of, you know, anyone who's 40 and over, that's their experience too. You didn't eat a lot of sushi growing up. But now we have sushi is everywhere, right? And now you have generations of people who have now been growing up and eating it weekly, monthly, all the time. It's not just a special meal anymore. And you can go anywhere and there's all sorts of different kinds of experiences in sushi. And so the guests themselves are getting a lot more savvy. They're getting a little more educated. They're wanting more. They're spending more on dinner. Dinner has now become kind of more of a entertainment as along with dinner. And we find ourselves in our restaurants almost trying to think about it as a show, you know, whereas before it was a restaurant and now it's, you know, how are they going to experience the food? What does the staff look like? You know, how are they acting? You know, and I think a lot of restaurants are that way now. You're thinking about the restaurant holistically as more than just a place to eat food, but an experience for a couple of hours. And I think that's really what, you know, what's changing for sushi and especially in the guest experience.
Right. That's interesting, right? So people used to think sushi is only available in this city, that city, but I think it's becoming a universal language, like you said. It's available everywhere and there's just a healthful image of it. And people really familiar with eating raw fish, which was almost laughable. I heard in 1950s and 60s. So yeah, it's amazing how sushi became very well accepted and also kind of developing it on its own in this country. That really is exciting.
Yeah, you know, growing up, you know, every now and then my mom, you know, she would make a big futomaki sushi roll. And she'd put it in my lunchbox, you know, and I would be so excited. I'd go to school, lunchtime, I would eat this sushi roll. And everybody in the school is, ew, what is that? That's gross. You know, and I became kind of embarrassed about it. Now I'm like the most popular guy in the city, you know, because I make sushi, right? So that's how far we've come.
Right. And very fast. So, yeah. So, but still though, you are in the Midwest. It's not, you are not facing the ocean. And so what's the biggest challenge of making sushi in Benson, Nebraska, where seaports are far away and sushi culture is still relatively nascent within this country? So the biggest challenges or?
Yeah. You know, for guests, you know, we have to recognize that we are the ones that have to introduce sushi culture. You know, we can't just give you food and walk away and not tell you why it's important or even how to eat it. And I think that's where a lot of sushi restaurants get wrong. They just make sushi and, you know, if you're too stupid to do it right, you know, that's your problem. But for us, we need to be good ambassadors of the cuisine. And so we need to help train and help people appreciate it better. You know, so first, we have to be good ambassadors. We have to teach the sushi culture here, where the experience level isn't what it is in Los Angeles or New York. And then sourcing fish, you know, I've been in the industry a long time and I've been in it in a corporate level. So I have, you know, pretty decent connections, you know, for getting fish, but, you know, getting Michelin level fish or getting, you know, really the best of the best, getting a good pick, you know, out of the markets is the challenge, right? You know, there's, and having those connections, you know, so even at for the Ota counter and all omakase counters, anyone can order fish from Japan. That's easy, right? You know, if you can get Japanese fish kind of no problem. And for almost every restaurant, that is the sign of quality. They just say, this fish came from Japan. But there's a vast level of quality of fish in Japan. There's still bad fish in Japan. And so when a restaurant just tells you, oh, the sushi came or the fish came from Japan, and that's it, that's interesting. And that's better than a lot of the fish that is coming into the United States. But that's not really a sign that it's the best product. And so the challenge here for us is relationships. Japanese culture and especially purchasing fish, any kind of business is about relationships, not just money. You know, developing a relationship over a long time with people you do business with, taking care of them, they take care of you. I don't even really discuss prices a lot. I just know someone's not going to take advantage of me. I'm going to not cheat on them, you know. And over time, improving your relationships, going to visit, saying hi, you know, taking them out to dinner, you know, or lunch, you know, at the market. And that's how we're improving our picks of fish, right? If there's 10 tuna to be had, one of them is still the best tuna. And using our relationships to help us get better fish has been the biggest challenge, especially with how far we are away. And, you know, being here in Nebraska, it's if you tell someone you're from New York or LA, they know what that is and it means something. But being from Nebraska, it's kind of the middle of nowhere. So it doesn't really like play very well to just, you know, we're just ordering fish to Nebraska. They're just not going to send you the best stuff. And so, right. You know, it's all about relationships.
Right. Yeah. I heard it's the traditional way to get the best fish. It sometimes takes generations to establish the relationships at the fish market, even right. Tsukiji and Toyosu. So that's amazing. And I mean, the truth is that it's probably more important even to send the best quality fish in somewhere outside big cities to inspire new guests, sushi guests. So I think what you're doing is really meaningful to inspire diners, educate diners' palate in the Midwest, which sounds like a big future of sushi market. So, but you still have 3 restaurants and it must be very hard to order everything and maintaining the quality. So what keeps you going and what are your plans and dreams?
What keeps me going? Well, I owe the bank a lot of money. So I have to keep going to work. Or I'm going to be homeless. No, but really it's, you know, we open more restaurants because I want to, create more and new experiences for my city and give them some of the things that bigger cities have and access to food and things like that they would have to travel for. You know, and then, you know, restaurants, even big restaurants, they don't make that much money. And so I actually, you know, I'm quite poor. I cannot retire on one restaurant. I have to open more or I will be working like Jiro-san and I will be 94 years old and having to make sushi. So there has to be some sort of retirement, you know, and so we have to open more restaurants so I can make more money to someday retire. But really the omakase counter Ota, it really keeps me excited. It's my dream to work a counter. It's my dream to make better sushi and improve my skills. And so every week, you know, I get to still make sushi I get to improve my skills and practice. But then, you know, outside of that, I get to visit the other restaurants, work with the chefs, work new menus. My life is it's really busy and stressful, but it's very exciting. I'm always working on something new.
I cannot imagine you ever retire. You're going to stay young and excited like a teenager. And that's very, very good, exciting. So what are your plans and dreams?
So, you know, my dream is to work my OTA counter for as long as my body will let me work my counter, improving my sourcing and just trying to, you know, my dream is to make sushi as good, you know, as my heroes, you know, Keiji Nakazawa and Takashi Saito, Endo-san at Ebisu Endo, you know, Koji Kimura. My dream is to someday people talk, you know, about a meal at my counter like they talked about a meal at, you know, at a legendary counter like those. But then I'd like to open some more restaurants, you know, bring more Japanese food and experiences to my city and my region, you know, and that's it. You know, it's really to just make food. I really do enjoy cooking and making sushi. I want to keep doing that for as long as I can.
Right. Well, I've never been to Nebraska, so you created a good reason for me to visit.
Please come.
Right. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
You know, so it's all the usual places. You know, of course, we've got a Koji, Ota, and Yoshitomo Facebook. Those are easy to find. And then really everything else I do is on Instagram, and we have accounts on those as well. I try to keep my experience with the internet as low as possible. And so really we just put all of our stuff on Instagram and then put it on Facebook, and that's it.
Okay, so the Instagram, it's Yoshitomo_sushi, and Koji is Izakaya Koji, KOJI, and Ota, Omakase_Ota.
Yep, and then, you know, I have you know, my own personal where it all starts on mine, and then I disseminate the information on the rest. So it's my David Yoshitomo on Instagram.
Cool, right? So that's David Yoshitomo, YOSHITOMO. Awesome. So good luck. And James Beard, good luck. But also you're going to have a lot of exciting things I can feel. So yeah, wish you luck. And maybe you can come back sometime in the near future to keep us updates.
Yes, I'd love that.
All right. So thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or kikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is William Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.